Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday and this hour of the program. In the current issue of Mother Jones magazine, Paul Roberts has a very interesting article titled Spoiled: Our Industrial Food System is Rotten to the Core, but Heirloom Arugula Won't Save Us. He covers a lot of interesting issues here, including organic farming, including the amount of money we pay for food, including variations on organic farming, and he also looks quite a bit at what would happen if we all went meat and without dairy at least one day a week. We're going to be looking at, how we reduce our carbon footprint on this earth and who's doing something about it. And in the meantime, how do you feed billions of people? Can you do it with some grow local kinds of movements, or does that fall short of the mark? Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. I assume some of you have already had a chance to read this article, and so that would be good. And Paul is joining us right now. Hi, Paul. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Yeah. Why don't you start with this visit with the guy you call the unrepentant industrial farmer, Fred Fleming?
Well, I guess what intrigued me about Fred was that, to step back a bit, my sort of initial question had been if the current status quo industrial farming model doesn't work, what's next? And really what's out there sort of that people are familiar with when they think of alternative are things like organic or local. And it struck me that those models, at least as they're being practiced today, aren't sufficient to, feed, the billions of people that we're going to be feeding over the next half century. And so I was interested in finding alternatives to the alternatives, or maybe something in between. And Fred is seemed like a great candidate. He's a third generation wheat farmer in eastern Washington state. He comes from a long line of industrial farmers, folks who have used the latest technology and chemicals, whatever the industry was putting out, they were using to get sort of more bushels per acre. But he discovered that in the process he was losing his most precious asset, his soil. In eastern Washington wheat farming, the model had been to till repeatedly to sort of prepare the soil between your plantings. And the problem was that you till the soil and you leave it very fragile and it's very vulnerable to erosion, wind, and rain. And he was losing, he could see just, you can lose tons of soil from every acre for every year. And it just goes, he was watching his legacy going out into the Pacific Ocean, essentially. So he wanted to try a different kind of farming where instead of tilling, you poked the wheat seed through the sod. You left the sod intact, so you didn't till it up. And you used what they call a seed drill to poke the wheat seed through the sod, and you let it come up through the sod. And, he's by no means the first farmer to practice what they call no-till. It was just sort of novel in that part of the state and with that crop. And he was able to get, roughly the same output, but in a way that really cut down his erosion. So there's the benefit is that he's cutting down erosion. The possible twist here, the wrinkle, was that because he's not tilling up, in the same way that you use a hoe in your garden to control weeds, because he wasn't tilling regularly, weeds were more likely to come into his field, and so he was controlling them with Roundup, which is, by Monsanto, and it's a very powerful chemical herbicide and has a lot of downsides. But, his view was he wasn't using as much as a conventional farmer was, and he was, in exchange for that negative, he was getting the positive of better soil and less erosion. So, but there's no market for that. There's not like a product. It doesn't qualify as organic, so you can't charge the price premium for it. It also disturbs a lot of organic farmers because they feel like, well, I won't speak for all of them, obviously, but they feel like, it feels like a slippery slope if you're going to be using a little chemicals, and why not a lot?
Right.
But it struck me that, okay, but here's at least an attempt to bridge this gap between where we are now and where we need to be. And I just thought it was interesting, particularly since it was coming from a guy who you know, what he kind of described himself as a recovering industrial farmer, you know. So that was sort of where that piece started, and then, you know, I really wanted to just explore sort of the limits to our the familiar alternatives, and sort of ask, well, if these aren't going to work at least as they are right now, what how do we feed people sustainably?
Right. When most of us, let me hear you answer this, what you think we imagine and what you imagine. When you write, when most of us imagine what a sustainable food economy might look like, chances are we picture what?
Well, we picture a, you know, just a larger version of things like organic and or local. I mean, I think, again, those are the models that most mainstream consumers are familiar with. Someone says, what's alternative? Okay, I'm going to, you know, buy from a local farm. I'm going to buy organic food. We know, we sort of sense that that's a very small percentage of the total production. It's, you know, just a few percent of our food supply is produced through those methods. So we assume, many of us, that we just have to scale those up and that we'll somehow do it. And there are just problems to scaling those particular things up, those particular models up. And so we need to sort of ask, what can we do in, you know, in, at large scale that, you know, that requires radically less chemicals, that is much better for our soil, that uses less water perhaps, requires less or no chemical fertilizers, and is going to be sufficient, you know, and less energy, by the way, because, of course, the industrial farm model is highly dependent on cheap energy, and is going to do all those things while managing to produce enough food to feed not just the current 6.5 billion, but the roughly 9 to 10 billion that we'll have, you know, by mid-century. And I got to tell you, I don't know if you've looked at the Mother Jones website, but I got a raft. I you know, it's like walking to a hornet's nest.
I imagine, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, part of it was I did not provide a very nuanced discussion of organic. And the truth is that organic is far too... It's an insufficient term because there are a lot of people who are practicing what you might call organic, but they're doing things much more creatively, and they're coming up. There's all kinds of ideas out there with, you know, that people have for making say organic more amenable to large scale production, or doing things that aren't really organic, but they're beyond organic, the next step beyond organic. So, you know. I certainly could have spent more time. It was sort of lumping organic into one thing, which wasn't very useful on my part. But you know, what was interesting was that a lot of the complaints about the story centered on some of the very sort of myths that I had been trying to undercut. For example, people gave me a hard time about my dismissal of small farms, and I wasn't dismissing them, but I was saying, you can't feed a world with small farms. And they were saying, look, you know, I've got these people complaining and say, well, we are. Look at, you know, most of the foods, the world's people are fed with small farms. And my reply to that is, you know, these are not people who chose to be small farmers. If you look at, you know, developing regions, if you look at places like sub-Saharan Africa, yes, it's true. Most of the people there are feeding themselves or are being fed via small farms, but they're not doing so happily, and they're not doing so voluntarily. They're doing so because there's nothing else to do. And given a chance, many of those people would leave the farm and do something else, or they would happily consolidate their operation, join up with another farmer, make a larger operation. So, you know, we have to be very careful about looking out at the world with a sort of a romantic lens.
And they're probably not all that able to feed themselves very well.
That's true. There's, you know, it obviously varies depending on where you're looking, but many of these small farmers are actually net importers of grain. They use that term. They buy their grain as opposed to produce enough of it, which means they're relying on imports, which raises a whole other question about food security. It was sort of the model that we, as the United States and other exporters, pushed in the 90s and 80s was, look, You countries, you have all these inefficient small farmers. That doesn't make a lot of sense. You should push them into factories in the cities, and we'll sell you very cheap grain because we've got these big industrial farms, and it makes more sense for you to buy our grain and to use your manpower to do other things. Well, that was great when grain was cheap, but then when grain prices went up, suddenly you know, the logic of that model was exposed is incredibly flawed. And we realized that, no, we do need to probably reconsider this notion of food sovereignty and food self-sufficiency. So countries do need to be producing more of their own food. And yet, the small farm model truly is, there are problems with it. So, you know, that's a whole other issue. I didn't really get into that in the article, but it does, it points up how complicated this is. And, you know, people are really sort of hungry for change. I mean,
yes.
And you can see that everywhere, whether it's food safety, the quality of the food, concerns about the damage that, that food production methods have for the environment, all those things are getting more and more attention. And, you know, books like Omnivore's Dilemma, you know, Michael Pollan has really turned this concern about food into a genre, so that now suddenly people have, they're not just worried sort of without focus about their food supply. They can see that there's a systematic problem to how food's being produced. So people are aware that the system itself is flawed. And yet, when we ask, okay, how do we replace that, that's where we don't really have any solid answers. Or we don't have consensus. Because there are lots of answers. There are lots of people coming up with proposals. I mean, what's really interesting about food, and I sometimes draw parallels between the food system and the energy system because they're both in trouble. They both need to change. There's obviously a lot of links between food and energy. But what's and people are coming up with their own solutions for energy, but not nearly to the degree as food. Food is one of these things that you have much more power over, and there's much more room for individual action. And so you're seeing the most amazing innovation out there, and it's unfortunately it's not getting the attention it deserves, and there's not really a network or a system for finding these ideas out there and distributing them, and that's something that I think as a culture we need to work on.
One of the ideas that caught my attention, and I know that people have talked about this, but what a difference it might make if everybody did this. You talk about the benefits of individual actions like not eating meat and not having dairy one day a week being, according to a Carnegie Mellon University report, more environmentally beneficial than eating locally every single day.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of one of the things that I wanted to get at, was that sometimes what seems obvious in terms of what would be a beneficial change isn't as beneficial or is more complicated than we think. For example, a lot of emphasis these days on eating locally, and one of the presumed advantages is that you'll use less energy and, you know, generate fewer carbon emissions because, you know, the food is traveling fewer food miles. And the problem is that that isn't always the case. Transportation is important, and yes, our food does travel an average, and the figure you see is the average item that you buy in the supermarket has traveled 1,500 miles. So, yes, a lot of fuel is being used to transport that, and a lot of emissions are being generated. But keep in mind that there's a couple of sort of qualifications that really need to be considered. The first is that, you know, if you're buying, say, from a farmer's market, and all those farmers are bringing their food in with small trucks or, you know, vans, they might be collectively using more energy and producing more emissions than, say, a single truck that's buying the Safeway grocery store. Now, a lot of people debate, okay, and there's certainly a lot of advantages, reasons to be shopping locally that don't have anything to do with energy. I mean, it's hugely important that we support that kind of business, reconnecting consumers with producers so that people, kids especially, can see where their food comes from. I mean, there's so much value there that's hard to put a figure on, but it's clearly important. Those are valuable, but we need to maybe distinguish those benefits from sort of quantifiable benefits like energy. And then you've got the transportation issue, but then you also have to recognize that transportation is only a small fraction of the energy consumed in the making of a particular food product. Far more energy is consumed in things like processing and packaging. So then you realize, okay, so if it's locally made but processing was energy intensive, maybe it used just as much energy. And as important is what the food is itself. I mean, if you're eating a lot of meat and dairy, those require lots of grain to go into the animals, and grain is very energy intensive. So it turns out that you can, as you mentioned, the one study, you can do more to reduce your sort of carbon footprint or your energy footprint by going meatless or dairyless once a week than you can by, you know, sourcing all your foods locally. Now, again, that's not to say that you shouldn't be emphasizing local. There are lots and lots of other reasons for supporting local, for being involved with local food. But if you are interested in something that's sustainable from, and you're interested in cutting your energy intake, it may be that changing your diet is as important. And ultimately, that's going to have to be a big part of this. We're sort of hoping that if we just buy food that's, say, organically produced or locally produced, we can go on eating as we are eating, and we don't have to alter our choices. And it may be that that's not possible. The average American consumes, or more accurately, causes to be produced more than 200 pounds of meat every year.
Oh, my.
Which is, it's astonishing. I mean,
yes.
if you think about that, it's huge. And that number needs to be sort of qualified as well, because what that means is that's the amount of meat that was produced for each of us. A lot of it gets lost on the way to us, so there's a lot of wastage. But the point is that we live in a system where that much meat is produced for each man, woman, and child. Because it takes, on average, 8 pounds of grain to make every pound of meat, a pound of edible meat, your impact every time you eat a pound of meat is eightfold on the system. So you need eight times the amount of water, of land, fertilizers, you name it,
mm-hmm.
and as you would if you were simply eating the grain straight. Now, eating the grain straight is sort of tough. I mean, it's hard to imagine a diet of that, but somewhere in the middle is probably where we need to be. And, this isn't to advocate total vegetarianism, although that's certainly an argument people make. There is a sustainable level of meat consumption that we could have. And I've seen figures, where instead of eating 9 ounces of meat a day like most Americans do, down to somewhere like just over 3 ounces, that would be sustainable. And it would be, you'd get your nutritional requirements and all that. But that, if we imagine the American level globally, the planet would simply collapse. It couldn't do it. So, clearly that's one of the places we have to start when we talk about sustainability. And yet, that is a really tough thing for a lot of people to get their minds around when they're thinking about, going to a sustainable food system, because they're hopeful, again, that all they have to do is buy a new product with a different label on it. They won't really have to stop buying the product, altogether.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Paul. Paul Roberts is our guest. Perhaps you've seen his piece in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine. Spoiled, our industrial food system is rotten to the core, but heirloom arugula won't save us. 800-486-8655. We'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Paul, and let's start with Karen from Marathon. Hi, Karen.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Good morning. I have a question for Mr. Roberts. There's been many different concerns that people have brought up over the years regarding chemicals and possible side effects on the health of individuals. And I'm just wondering if there have been any studies in the U.S. that might support increased cancer rates in the areas where there are large industrial farming sites or even family-run businesses in certain areas that have very large tracts of land that they farm. And if so, is there any specific type of cancers that seem to result from that?
Okay, that's not what this article is about, but you may know something about this, Paul.
Yeah, I can. I mean, if there are, it's a pretty contentious area, but there are certainly studies that suggest that in areas like the Midwest, where there's a lot of intensive industrial farming, you have a higher rate of cancers. For a long time, sort of anecdotally, it was understood that the cancer researchers would go to Iowa because to do some of their work and do their research, because it was there that they could find a lot of these exotic cancers that weren't found with nearly the same frequency elsewhere. And there was a lot of concern that had to do directly with that area's kind of fame as being sort of the epicenter of the industrial model. So there's concerns about that. There were concerns about atrazine, which is a farm chemical, an herbicide that's used in corn farming especially, and has a lot of impact, sort of acknowledged impacts on things like amphibians, so wildlife, and certainly a lot of concerns about what it might be doing to human health. I'm not an oncologist, and I'm not I'm not familiar enough with the literature about the links between farm chemicals and various cancers to speak on that. But it is definitely an area of concern, and it's one of the reasons that initially people have were interested in moving away from that model. So absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And thanks very much for the call. Kurt is next from Springbrook. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, I'd like to ask Mr. Roberts, what do hunter-gatherers and small-scale horticulturists have to teach us about sustainability in our food system?
Oh, wow, that's a great question.
Well, I come from the perspective that, for about 99.9% of our existence on Earth as human beings, we lived as hunter-gatherers, and, we managed to not destroy the planet. So here we are, and I just wonder, what do they have to teach us?
I think that, it's a really important question for a lot of reasons. I think that the hunter-gatherer model works until it doesn't, and one of the reasons it stopped working, we theorize, was that we either did away with a large game that had supported us, and or climactic changes also made it harder and harder to hunt. We went from larger game to smaller game, and then that became harder to support. So we moved to agriculture, not because everyone said, hey, farming is fun. It's very hard. But I think because it was more and more it was the strategy that allowed more people to survive. So you end up with this farming model that has pluses and minuses. It allows you to produce surpluses of grain, which means that not everyone has to farm, which means you can specialize. So some people can be scribes, some people can be engineers, and you have specialization and therefore the rudiments of civilization. On the other hand, your diet changes so much, moving from this sort of varied diet that had meat and roots and all sorts of food, which we're designed for, to a diet that's primarily starch. The sort of nutrition and health problems associated with that are tremendous. We're still dealing with that. But the question of whether we could go back to that sort of model, hunter-gatherer, it's very problematic. The land required, sort of the territory required for each person to be a hunter-gatherer is tough. Obviously now we're heavily urbanized. Interestingly, the agricultural revolution is one of the things that allowed us to move to the cities. You could have a small number of farmers producing enough food to feed all the people that were in the city. But on the other hand, it sort of locks us into the city because now we're living here. We don't have the skills, most of us, to produce our own food. We don't have the land or access to the land. So the hunter-gatherer model, I think, as a strict model, it's probably not as useful to us now. However, the thing that it does remind us is that we are still designed to be hunter-gatherers. Our brains are designed to be looking for those kinds of things. We're designed to think about strategies, survival strategies. And I think that's going to be really critical in the next century because most of the models that are under discussion now, whether we replace industrial farming with organic farming, or whether we build these huge urban horticulture farms, these skyscraper greenhouses, which I also mentioned in the article, and those are all great, but those all assume that food production is separate from where it's being consumed. In other words, there'll be producers, and there will be farmers. They might just wear different clothes and use different technologies, but there'll be farmers. And then there's the rest of us, consumers. And I think one of the things that we're going to have to shift is that all of us need to be producers in a sense. We need to really lose this distinction between producers and consumers. I think it's one of the things that has got us into trouble. Because now we consumers are utterly dependent and reliant on a production model. And now that we're realizing that production model is faulty, we go, okay, great, but now who's going to make our food and how? I think we need to move back to a producer mentality. Maybe that, now we don't all have the option to go and hunt and gather. We don't all have the option to grow food in our backyards, but many of us do. But even if we began to retake some of that production, cooking more, processing more, being part of a local, a CSA, a community garden, even taking back some measure of production, I think, would be critical to our mindset. And that's something that we don't really talk about. We would kind of imagine, you know, farming as being done by farmers. But in a sense, I think we're all going to have to be farmers again if we're going to make this transition really work.
Thanks very much. And also considering, as you cite in the article, the number of people in the world, 70% of the world's population living in or near cities. So we're going to have to farm in those cities, right?
I think so. I think that we're going to have to, I mean, we have to sort of face facts here. One is that, you know, most of more than half of us are going to live in cities. I think more than half of us already do, and that number is certainly going to increase. So the reality is that most of the world is in urban areas where you can't easily grow food. So urban areas will be dependent on rural areas for their food, and there will be transportation, and there will be global transportation, you know, because of food. As much as we'd like to have more of a local and regional model, we have to recognize that, you know, countries like China and India will depend on exporters like the United States for the foreseeable future. So there is going to be absolutely global trade in food, and there's no way to get around that. We need to make sure that global trade is fair and sustainable, which isn't the case today. But we shouldn't imagine that we can do without it. And having said that, I think we also need to recognize that we could move food production into the cities to a far greater degree than we do today. And that's something that needs to be looked at and is being looked at. That's what's one of the most exciting things about some of the innovation that's coming out of this is people really have begun to sort of embrace this notion of urban horticulture in a serious way. And we're seeing everything from, you know, these really grand plans to build, again, these sort of skyscrapers, these greenhouse skyscrapers, kind of self-contained, very efficient, massive, you know, basically food factories right in the city, all the way down to rooftop gardens to, programs where at-risk kids are actually being brought in and taught how to farm in the city. They're producing their own food, and it's having tremendous sort of psychological and social benefits. But there's a lot of potential there that I think is really just now being tapped into. And there's a group of these two business school students have come up with this idea to put hydroponic greenhouses on top of grocery stores. You know, they've measured the number of sort of acres, if you will, of grocery store rooftop in the country, and it's quite a resource. Mm. And hydroponic doesn't have soil, so it's not a weight issue. And it's tremendous. It's like, what could be fresher than having your produce
of course
grown, you know,
grown right there? Are we talking cows too?
No,
no.
But you know what's funny here is that if you imagined a grocery store doing this, and they reckon these two students reckon, I shouldn't call them students anymore, they're businessmen, right? At this point, but it's called Sky Vegetables. If your listeners want to Google that. And, you know, they said, well, look, we can, a lot of the, a huge fraction of the price that you pay for your fresh produce in the market when you buy it today is sort of generated in the farm field and in the transportation of that. And that if you could be producing it, you know, on the rooftop, you could make it affordable. And so, I mean, that's great. But then it sort of begs the question of what we regard as sustainable and our ideas of sustainability. Because if your local grocery store is doing that, then that's great. But what if, you know, Walmart wants to do that? Do we still regard that as sustainable? Is that still a good thing? And this really gets to this another, what I think is an under-discussed part of sustainability. You know, everyone's kind of, I mean, we're sort of preaching to the choir in the sense that there's a lot of folks who are already interested in sustainability, and if their consumers are willing to maybe pay a little bit more for organic or for locally produced. And that's fine. I mean, that's good. That's the way these sort of new sectors get started. But, again, we're wanting to find a way to produce sustainable food for everybody. And, you know, you go to a place in sub-Saharan Africa and you say, okay, how do we produce sustainable food or organic food here?
Yes.
I mean, it's certainly doable, but there's a lot of challenges there. What about, you know, the areas in this country? You know, in some of the big cities, you know, you have these whole areas, neighborhoods that don't have access to a grocery store, you know, that we, you know, call these food deserts. And, you know, how do we get fresh produce, sustainable produce to them? Sustainable food has to be, I think it has to be one of the criteria, it has to be affordable. You know, the Kellogg Foundation has come up with a criteria for sustainable food that I think is really worth talking about. And it says that there are four, you know, criteria which really that have to be met. And you know, the first is that it's environmentally sustainable, so it's produced in an environmentally safe way. And the second is that it's, produced without any injustice, so you're not using, you know, exploited farm labor. And then the last two are ones that we don't hear enough about. The third is that it has to be nutritious. And, you know, you could have an organic Twinkie, for example, and a Twinkie with organic ingredients, but it's not going to be a nutritious. And lastly, it has to be affordable. You know, if you're growing fresh produce, local produce, it's only affordable by sort of upper-income people, you're not really dealing with the sustainability question, or at least the question that needs to be answered. So, and then that takes us back to questions about, you know, sort of this pure notion that, let's say we could produce food, sustainable food that used a lot less chemicals, you know, fewer farm chemicals. Let's say we cut down our pesticide use by, you know, down to 10%. So we remove 90% of the pesticide use, but we want the ability to be able to use to spray if we can't get rid of those pests through an organic means. We want that sort of fallback. And if we have that fallback, it turns out that we can reduce the overall cost of our food and therefore make it more affordable. Now, is that a trade-off that makes sense? You know, if you're an organic purist, you'd say no, it's a slippery slope, and that's a valid argument. But I wonder whether we're going to find ourselves, you know, 10 or 20 years from now when we're trying to feed so many people, I wonder whether we're going to have to, you know, those are the kinds of compromises we might be forced to make.
How much did Fred cut his pesticide use by? Was it a lot, 90% or half? Or
It depends on where in his field he's talking about, and he hasn't done he hasn't had it measured in a way that I feel comfortable, you know, saying this or that. I can say that, you know, you can point to some other really interesting work there is a researcher at Iowa State University who's come up with this really novel alternative system. And keep in mind that Iowa State is, again, you know, this is like the epicenter of the industrial farm model. But this guy's come up with a model that cuts pesticide and chemical fertilizer use by about 80%. And what he does is he recognizes that, you know, you use pesticides, or in this case herbicides, to get weeds. Well, weeds come from seeds, right? So if you could find some way to kill the seeds before they sprouted, your weed problem would go away. Well, it turns out that he started watching and he realized that there's already a mechanism for eating weed seeds, and it's rodents. Rodents and certain insects will decimate a weed seed population if they're allowed to live. Now, farmers have traditionally wanted to get rid of rodents, but when they realized that they could, you know, actually take care of their weed seed problem by promoting these little field mice and others. So he's come up with a model that promotes these populations of mice who then take out most of the weed seeds by themselves. And he's reduced his herbicide use by about 80%.
Oh.
And he hasn't hurt his productivity. Now, he's also doing things like these crop rotations so that he is fertilizing naturally. He's using crops. He's using cover crops of legumes to put nitrogen back in the soil, so he's not having to use as much synthetic fertilizer. He is using some, but he's reducing it again by 80%. And his output is roughly the same as an industrial model. Now, you're looking at that and you're thinking, okay, wow, that's a lot of, you know, he could do this at scale. It doesn't, you know, get rid of the chemicals, but it reduces them substantially. And does that count? I mean, should we look at that favorably, or is that not good enough? You know,
right.
And it's these are. I think this is the debate that we've got to have. you know, you if you ask that question, the question I've just asked, it's really easy. You know, I could be for any of your listeners know, I could be working for Monsanto and sort of saying, you know, hey, some chemicals are fine. Because, you know, if you're Monsanto and you're hearing a conversation like this, you're thinking, geez, Louise, great, there goes our market. You know, what can we sell people if they're, you know, hiring mice to eat their weed seeds?
Right. Let's go to some more phone calls. Lynn from Kewaunee is next. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I'm a 100% grass-fed beef producer. And isn't it time that we really start looking at the paradigm change? You know, right now, 80% of our grain crop is going to feed animals. We could put these animals out on pasture and rotationally graze. I do it. My total fuel cost for last year was less than $500. And I'm producing, you know, the same amount of animals on my acreage as if I was doing it conventionally. I use no pesticides, no herbicides. Isn't it time that we really take a look at our a true paradigm shift away from that this grain model?
Yeah, I think that Lynn, I think that you're absolutely right, and I think that your suggestion kind of brings up a number of really important points here.
Thank you.
The first is that, you know, we do have a model for producing meat sustainably, and it's the one that he talks about, grain-fed, or rather grass-fed, and there are, you know, other foraging models for other kinds of meat. So, I mean, if you're not morally or ethically opposed to meat, then there are certainly ways, absolutely ways, to produce it sustainably. And more importantly, it's very hard to imagine a food system, an agricultural system, in which animals are not present. You know, animals are sort of critical to this notion of a self-sufficient nutrient cycling system. You need animals in the system. You absolutely do. You may not decide that you're going to eat them, or you may decide that you're only going to produce eggs and dairy from them. But the point is that you absolutely need animals. And what one of the problems with the industrial model is that we've separated animals from sort of farming. You know, where farmers used to have livestock and crops, and they used to be intimately connected, where you fed your animals from your own field and you used your animal manure to fertilize your field. We separated that function because we could now use chemical fertilizers to fertilize the fields, and we could feed our animals with, you know, this high-output corn, so we no longer had to have them together. Well, you know, that was great, but it also created a whole host of new problems. So if we imagine rejoining those two functions, then we have something that along the lines that Lynn's talking about, and that's something we really need to investigate. I think the closer we look at that model, though, I think what we realize is that as productive as his operation may be, there's a limit to how much meat we can produce using these sort of grass-fed sustainable models. One of the reasons we were able to produce so much more meat in this country was because we shifted from a purely grass-fed model to a model in which the animals are grass-fed up to a certain point and then they're corn-fed. That allowed us to kind of exceed our acres because we were now feeding with corn instead of just grass.
Paul Roberts is our guest. His piece is in the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine. Spoiled, our industrial food system is rotten to the core, but heirloom arugula won't save us. Two more phone calls in a moment. And keep the number in your head because we're pretty crowded. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, we go next to Jerry from Milwaukee. Hello, Jerry.
Hi there. I think your guest has touched on some of my questions and answered them concerning rooftop farming, urban vertical farming. But when you get back to the model, it seems as if this last caller, Lynn, talking about a paradigm shift, almost as if we eat just too much meat, and that why our diet has to change. When you look at portion size, we way overeat meat, which, you know, encourages grain production, which encourages the wrong kind of ag business.
I mean, I sort of went on a little long there, but that was the point that I was going to get back to, and thanks for thanks for disciplining me there. Really, you know, if you look at this kind of sustainable model that we're talking about, let's say grass fed, and you've got a natural limit acres of grass, and we recognize from our huge mistakes we made last century that you can't overgraze certain areas because you create things like dust bowls. So you have natural limits, and once you understand those, you have a certain number of acres you can use for grass-fed beef, for example, which means you have a limit to the supply, which means that there's going to be a price rise. You're probably going to be paying more for it. And, you know, obviously the better we get at it, the more efficient we get at it, we can control that price. But I believe that the higher price would sort of force us to eat less meat. Now, there's, you know, because one of the reasons we eat so much meat is that it got so cheap. And that it's not simply that we eat more meat and that causes more demand for grain. It's that we were able to grow more grain, so we said, what are we going to use this grain for? Oh, we'll put it into cows and pigs and chickens, and that helped drive our meat costs down, which then signaled to consumers, hey, eat more meat. I mean, historically, over the last, you know, thousands and thousands of years, meat has been a very expensive thing, and that's one of the reasons we haven't eaten very much of it. We've entered a period of the last century when meat was very cheap, artificially cheap, as we now understand. Now we're having to recognize we need to go back to a model in which the price of meat is allowed to rise. Now that sounds great in a country like the United States, where we aren't struggling so much with food security. You make that argument in other parts of the world. Basically, you're suggesting let's make food more sustainable and more expensive, and you're talking about widespread food insecurity. So that's the other part of the equation we really haven't gotten to, and it's one that we're really going to have to get to if we're going to make sustainable real.
Thank you, Jerry, unless you had more.
Well, the urban roof garden is a great idea. When you fly into O'Hare Airport, you see acres and acres of underutilized roofs, and I just thought that was an inspirational idea.
Yes, it is.
And I certainly hope that they get covered with greenhouses soon.
I do, too. We're going to do a show on that at some point. It came up yesterday as well. So we'll look at the good that Chicago is doing, and Milwaukee has a few of those buildings, and I'm sure other places do as well in the country. Jerry, thanks very much for the call. And let's go next to Rich from Boscobel. Hi, Rich.
Hey, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Good. Just wanted to remind your guests that the Dust Bowl wasn't caused by overgrazing. It was caused by plowing grazing land up to grow wheat. That's one thing. Your wheat farmer in Washington, who thought he made great strides by poisoning the land with Roundup and no-tilling his wheat, would have done even better if he'd restored the natural grass cover and pastured cattle on it. You know, we have to get in sync with nature and use this land for its best sustainable use. We had more sustainable farms in the Midwest back in the 50s and 60s than we do now, where, like you mentioned, the livestock was fed on the farm where the grain was produced, and the resulting manure was a valuable fertilizer. But even under our current system, you got to bear in mind the first 800 pounds of any beef animal is primarily put on with forage, you know, crops that are undigestible to humans, but essential for controlling erosion on highly erodible land. So, you know, it's not as dire a picture. You know, this 8 pounds of grain for every 1 pound of beef, I don't know where that figure came from, but it's utter nonsense.
Paul.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know where to start. Dust Bowl has a number of factors contributing to it. But let's focus on something we agree on. Finding a way to sort of persuade farmers to rethink what it is they're producing. You know, a lot of farmers think that they don't have a choice but to produce, you know, high-output wheat, and even if the land isn't suited for that. So I believe the caller is absolutely right that you could, you know, if you could find a way to show farmers, here's what your land is suitable for. Here's a product you could grow, let's say grass-fed beef, that would allow you to earn, you know, this roughly the same income. There's a question of expertise. You're going to have to, you know, a farmer's been growing wheat. It's a pretty tough transition to become a livestock producer, particularly if no one in your family's produced livestock for a while because you split those functions generations ago. The question about 8 pounds of the utter nonsense that the caller refers to about, you know, 8 pounds of grain to a pound of meat. As I did mention that, you know, the cow is fattened up on grass and then moved to grain. So in the case of cows, they are getting some of their calories on forage. But with chickens and pigs, that's not the case. So that's where that 8 pounds of grain to a pound of meat comes from. But again, I agree that finding ways, you know, if a farmer, if they're sort of habitually growing a particular product or commodity, even if that commodity is destroying their soil, it's very hard for these producers to switch gears. And one of the, I hope, one of the developments that has to come out of this sustainability debate is a new way to talk about this. Because right now, there's a lot of conventional farmers or industrial farmers, however you want to describe them, who are very fearful of having to change. They think they're going to lose money. They're going to have to take greater financial risks. They're going to have to embark on something that is very mysterious and uncertain. And they get very defensive about that. And not surprisingly, I mean, we all would if someone told us that the way our livelihood was totally wrong. And I think that we're going to have to find a way to sort of talk ourselves through this transition in a language that isn't so combative, because unfortunately right now there's sort of us and them. There's an us and them mentality. There's sort of the industrial model, and there's the right-thinking people, like me, of course, like you. And the truth is that we're all part of this industrial model. And if we're going to move from this industrial model, we're going to have to find a sort of an inclusive language, which is challenging because food is such an issue about which people have such passion and, you know, a lot of politics involved. But
Rich, thanks very much. We want to get to another call. Greg is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Thanks for having this conversation. I think it's great, but I think there's a viewpoint that's actually being glazed over, and that's I know the guest isn't pushing a vegan diet, but there's a lot to be said for a vegan diet. Animal meat production is the number one cause of deforestation in the world. The average vegan saves 1 acre of deforested land by just not eating meat and dairy products per year. The average vegan also saves 1.3 million gallons of water per year over a meat-based diet. Further, the way where we've got the standard American diet, and I know this is not what's going on across the globe, but the standard American diet is only really sustainable for about 2 billion people on the planet. And if we were to get off of the standard American diet and get into a vegan diet as the standard across the globe, there wouldn't be any hunger issues, because we'd be able to produce plenty of food for everybody that's currently living on the planet and then some.
Okay, I mean, in theory that's great, but let's unpack some of what you're saying. I mean, it's absolutely true that meat production is driving a lot of the unsustainable practices and is really adding to a load on the global, on natural systems, that's unsustainable. Agreed. But you, if you're going to say that meat production is the number one cause of deforestation, meat production under the current model, where we're eating as much, is what's driving that. If we went to a sustainable level of meat production, then by definition, we're not going to be causing deforestation. So the one question is, well, if there is a sustainable level, what is that? Now, let's also understand that there are two arguments here. One is a sort of a moral and ethical argument about whether we should be eating meat and animal products at all. The other is, can we be eating those in a sustainable way? I think we can be. If you choose not to, that's fine. That's a totally defensible argument, but let's not confuse those two issues. The second thing we have to keep in mind is that if we did find a sustainable level of meat production, and by that I mean, you know, a way of producing meat that doesn't have huge poop lagoons outside of these pork factories, that doesn't have deforestation, that doesn't require millions of tons of excess nitrogen fertilizer to end up, you know, creating dead zones offshore. It has to be sustainable, truly, but we need to, what level of meat consumption would that be? Now, again, some of the figures you see are 3 ounces of meat per person. You know, maybe that's high, maybe that's low. You know, we barely scratched the surface in terms of doing the research we need to do. The last issue you have to consider is that it's fine to talk about eating no meat in the United States. I mean, we could all get the protein and the nutrients we need without a scrap of meat. We know how to do that. We know how, for two reasons. We have the education, and we have the access to the other kinds of foods. That's not the case in a lot of the rest of the world. In fact, in many other parts of the world, adding meat to the diet is the single fastest way that you can raise nutritional standards and living standards. Now, it isn't necessarily the only way, But you have to keep in mind that we're living in a real world where vast populations are without the protein they need. The second thing you have to keep in mind is that while it might make sense for us not to produce meat, while our farmers might be able to get by without generating meat, it's a very different thing in parts of the developing world where livestock is a critical step in economic development. I mean, a lot of farmers start out by buying a few chickens, and then they go to a few goats, and then if they're lucky, they move up to cows. Without that sort of economic model that's absolutely centered on livestock, you've deprived them of a pathway to economic development. Now,
and on that note, Paul, we have to leave because we're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us.
Absolutely.
Paul Roberts, our guest, his piece is in the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. I'll next be with you on Monday for All Things Political starting at 9 o'clock. I hope you'll join us. Many hours of great conversation ahead on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.